Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For decades, Republicans have successfully suppressed the vote and gerrymandered districts to ensure minority rule. Now they have a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. Today's guest, historian Nancy McLean, writes about how we got here in her book, Democracy in Chains, the deep history of the radical right's stealth plan for America. She writes that the radical right's vast network does not want to simply change who rules. They want to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance. She also explores how billionaires have shaped the U.S. judicial system. Last year, the Washington Post reported that Leonard Leo, a Donald Trump confidant and executive vice president of the Federalist Society, helped conservatives raise $250 million from mostly undisclosed donors to promote conservative judges and causes. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, used his time at the confirmation hearing for now Justice Amy Coney Barrett to expose how dark money was playing a role in her nomination process. We've talked about Republicans' plans to reverse Roe, get rid of Obamacare, and take away gay marriage, but he says there's another piece of the plan that deserves far more attention. Here is a clip from Senator Sheldon Whitehouse.
And that is not what's ahead of us, but what's behind us. What's behind us is now 80 cases, Mr. Chairman, 80 cases under Chief Justice Roberts that have these characteristics. One, they were decided 5-4 by a bare majority. Two, the 5-4 majority was partisan in the sense that not one Democratic appointee joined the five. I refer to that group as the Roberts Five. It changes a little bit, as with Justice Scalia's death, for instance. But there's been a steady Roberts Five that has delivered now 80 of these decisions. And the last characteristic of them is that there is an identifiable Republican donor interest in those cases. And in every single case, that donor interest won. It was an 80-0, 5-4 partisan rout. Ransacking. And it's important to look at where those cases went, because they're not about big public issues like getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, undoing Roe versus Wade, and undoing same-sex marriage. They're about power. And if you look at those 80 decisions, they fall into four categories over and over and over again. One, unlimited and dark money in politics. Citizens United is the famous one, but it's continued since with McCutcheon, and we've got one coming up now. Always the 5-4, unlimited money in politics, never protecting against dark money in politics, despite the fact that they said it was going to be transparent. And who wins when you allow unlimited dark money in politics? A very small group. The ones who have unlimited money to spend and a motive to spend it in politics. They win, everybody else loses. And if you're looking at who might be behind this, let's talk about people with unlimited money to spend and a motive to do it. We'll see how that goes.
That was Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, who used his time at the confirmation hearing for now Justice Amy Coney Barrett to expose how dark money was playing a role in her nomination process. In addition to talking about Republicans' plans to reverse Roe, get rid of Obamacare, and really reverse so many other social programs, he said that we really need to start talking about corporate power. And that is one piece that deserves much more attention. Joining us to talk about all of this, including minority rule, how we got here, what we can do about it, and where we go from here, is Nancy McLean, an award-winning scholar and distinguished professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Nancy is author of the important book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Booklist called it perhaps the best explanation to date of the roots of the political divide that threatens to alter American government. Hi, Nancy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's great to be with you. I'm such an admirer of the show.
Oh, well, thank you. And we're an admirer of your work. When all of this went down in the last, well, really the last couple months with voter suppression, we thought we need to bring Nancy back to the show. We're just really wondering what you're thinking about with all, I mean, so much of what you wrote about in your book is really happening right before our very eyes.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, it's been very painful for me, as I think for everyone, but I feel a special kind of nausea because this was all, you know, I mean, you can't, of course, predict the exact outlines, but once you understand what this radical corporate right has been doing over decades, and you see each piece of it kind of closing in and getting locked in, the rest becomes almost, you know, I don't know, inescapable, you know, what's happening. It's rare for a historian to do this, but I have, you know, people have said the book has a predictive power for our moments. So it feels good to have uncovered a story that we didn't know before and that we wouldn't have known had I not happened by total coincidence on its roots in the late 1950s South. But it's really painful to see it play out because it's just so frustrating that on issue after issue that is before us in this country, majorities of Americans agree. We agree we need to take action on the climate. We agree that we need to have stronger public schools, that we need to pay teachers better, that we need to stop systemic racism. You know, there's just so many things where there is actually broad agreement, but these arch-right donors have captured the Republican Party and bent it to their purposes, and they are systematically rigging governance at every level, from the voter suppression and extreme gerrymandering you talked about to the attempt to destroy labor unions. They know that for every right to work law passed, on average, the vote for the Democrats goes down 3%. And most crucial this week has been their decades-long focus on the federal judiciary to change constitutional jurisprudence and to stack the federal bench above all the Supreme Court with justices that will rule in the corporate interest. And Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was magnificent in his presentation in the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. And I'm so glad that you played it extensively, because I think every American needs to hear what he had to say. It was just so important the way he tracked all of this. And he didn't even need to say anything about her as an individual. What he did is expose the process and the huge amount of funding that put her in the position where she is now, the sixth vote for this project on the Supreme Court.
And we will include a clip of his entire, I guess, speech, you can call it, at yourcallradio.org, because the entire speech is really worth listening to. You brought up a couple points there, Nancy, and I think the one you brought up about where Americans stand on issues is really important, because it's rare to hear this. And every time I hear about how divided we are, how partisan everything is, I think about this study that was conducted in 2014 by Princeton and Northwestern professors. And they found that the wealthy few move policy while the average American has little power. And they looked at answers to almost 2,000 questions about public policy asked between 1981 and 2002. And they found exactly what you just said. A majority of citizens, when they disagree with economic elites or special interests, they generally lose. But when fairly large majorities of Americans favor policy changes, like, you know, tax increases for the wealthy or a higher minimum wage or movement on climate change, they generally do not get it. And this is such an important point.
Yeah, it's deeply frustrating. And that's a great, it's a great book, and actually part of a growing literature in political science and in economics by people like, you know, Joe Stieglitz and Robert Reich, who are documenting how the very wealthy are rigging our political system in their favor so that it doesn't address the concerns and needs of average citizens. And actually what Mitch McConnell just did in the Senate is a perfect example of that. You know, they could not rush this nominee through fast enough, absolutely record time, you know, less than a month, you know, in the week before an election. And they did it furtively in the dark of night, and then they recessed. most Americans, including Republicans, did not think that was a legitimate process to have Amy Coney Barrett nominated and rushed through just before an election. But not only that, what Americans want attention to is what's happening to them in this pandemic, is the incredible crying need of people who have lost their jobs, people who have been evicted or stand to be evicted, of frontline communities and workers who still don't have the protective equipment and material need, and the localities and states that are about to have incredible fiscal crises because McConnell's Senate refused to provide any relief for state and local budgets. And that contrast between rushing to push through this nominee, who, as far as I'm concerned, she's Charles Koch's justice on the Supreme Court, rushing to do that unpopular thing while refusing to do the thing that the great majority of people want and need, tells us everything about the moment we've reached in our country, where the arch-right donors are, again, you know, have captured one of our major political parties, have turned it into something that longtime Republican voters don't recognize, many of them, and they are rigging the system at every step. So it's deeply frustrating. And the other thing that's also, and this is where I think even I mentioned earlier, the feelings of nausea, but these are people who will literally, at this point, I think it's fair to say and do almost anything to get power and to hold power and to keep power from the majority. And that is why they must rely on Fox News, which systematically misinforms its listeners, but goads them into a kind of embattled white identity politics and makes them think that the rest of the country is out to get them. Because when you have a stress response, you can't, you know, think rationally. And so they have Fox News. They have they've made alliances with the religious right, particularly these entrepreneurial Protestant evangelical leaders, white Protestant evangelical leaders, who are now Trump's most reliable voters. And they goad those people nonstop with these kind of, you know, red meat appeals while they are imposing an agenda that will be devastating to them. I mean, these people are seeking to eliminate Social Security and Medicare, to, you know, make them stop being entitlements, to push us into private individual accounts. They're undermining our public education system. They're trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and make sure there is no health insurance for people, even in a time of pandemic. So the stakes could not possibly be higher. And the way they are playing this game is just so frankly despicable that it's just deeply troubling to me as a historian of America. And, you know, Lord knows we've had our problems and challenges grave problems in American history. But I really can't point to conduct like what we're seeing now.
And to add one more poll to this conversation, in 2013, Business Insider polled registered voters and asked for their preferences among three congressional plans floated to avoid budget cuts. And they found that when they stripped the plan of their partisan labels, the policies most favorable to the majority were those offered by the progressive wing of the Democratic caucus. So Republicans chose progressive budget solutions over their own parties when the party name was stripped from the plan.
Yeah, I think that captures it perfectly, what's happening, Rose. I think we would all understand what's happening in our politics better if, instead of talking about, say, the Democrats and the Republicans or liberals and conservatives, we talked about the extreme right-wing wealthy versus the rest of us, because that's where we really are. This libertarian corporate cause is radical. It is radical and reactionary. And in the 1970s, they were honest, and Charles Koch himself was honest in the 1970s in saying that they were revolutionaries, that they were radical revolutionaries. They should never compromise. But what they learned is that if they wanted to acquire power and wield power, they had to fly under a false flag. And that false flag is conservatism. But I actually, in the introduction to the book, quote Orrin Hatch, when he was primaried by these people, he said, These people are not conservatives. They're not Republicans. These people are radical libertarians. I despise these people, were his words. But then, you know, fast forward, it was Orrin Hatch who denied President Obama even a hearing for Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court. So they basically bullied him into toeing the line. But he, like other Republicans who have fallen victim of this and been driven out of politics, have told us that this is not normal partisan activity. This party has been captured.
You argue that if the right played by the rules and did not suppress the vote and did not gerrymander districts and were honest with the people about what their game plan really is and their end game, they would never win elections. But what adds a little bit of confusion to all of this, Nancy, is the 2016 election, because while you had over 90 million people who did not vote, and I think that's such an important number to talk about, Donald Trump did get almost 63 million votes. So how do you square that?
Yeah, well, I think there are many things that explain Donald Trump's victory. I mean, one of them I think we have to pay attention to is the voters, and it was a minority of that number, but a significant number, I believe 6 or 9 million voters who voted twice for President Obama and then voted for Donald Trump. So I think, you know, it speaks to the larger problem of our politics, in which a kind of, you know, some people call it neoliberalism, some call it free market fundamentalism, but where many leading Democrats have presided over policies that were devastating to many working class communities, including, above all, trade pacts like NAFTA. So that, I think, is one part of an explanation. But also Mitch McConnell, from the very day after Barack Obama, you know, was elected, said we want to make him a one-term president, try to stop him from doing anything to deliver on what he promised to the people. So the Obama administration was under attack from this cause, as almost no previous one has been, in a kind of full frontal attack. So there's that. Of course, there's, you know, the racism. Of course, there's the religious appeals and other things. And there is, you know, the Trump vote is concentrated in what some people call the opioid belt, right? I mean, communities in which there has been long-term job loss, developing despair, et cetera, and mainstream Democrats have not addressed that in the way that they should. And so you have anger that gets bottled up and explodes. When I was writing this book, actually, I thought, why would anyone pursue policies like this to shackle government and keep it from doing the things that people want and need? Because we've seen this movie before. You know, it is the interwar crisis of the 20th century that produced fascism, you know, communism, and almost sunk us all, because when people can't get what they need from government, they don't give up and just go to sleep. They polarize, they radicalize, they go right, left, you know, and that's precisely what happened by 2016. You know, Bernie Sanders did incredibly well as a candidate of the left, and Donald Trump did incredibly well as a candidate of the right, and the candidate of the, you know, mainstream middle was, I mean, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote, but didn't excite voters.
There are major differences between the 2016 election and the upcoming election. What really stands out for you this time around? Because, you know, some people say Biden can get 5 million more votes than Trump and still lose the Electoral College. And a lot of people are thinking, with all of the damage that has been done, especially around COVID, how is it that Trump could still possibly get, you know, over 60 million votes? Who knows what's going to happen? But that's what people are talking about.
Yeah, well, part of it, you know, has to do with our Constitution and the imprint of slaveholders, the original, you know, hyper-capitalists in our country, their input and imprint on the U.S. Constitution. So the Electoral College is a huge issue here, as is the power of senators from relatively underpopulated areas, particularly, you know, that area of the Mountain West, whose 14 senators have more power than the, you know, huge population bases in your state, in California. So part of it is the misrepresentation that is built into our constitution, which is getting more and more extreme as population concentrates on the coasts and in cities. That's one piece, but also what the Republican Party has been doing over the last decade, but with mounting intensity, also matters. You know, I was just listening to a report yesterday about Georgia, where the number of voters scrubbed from the rolls in Georgia was precisely the margin that Stacey Abrams lost by. And they were scrubbed by the person she was running against, who also happened to be Secretary of State. And somehow that wasn't treated as an incredible conflict of interest. So we're seeing, you know, and you see that the Supreme Court just decided against Wisconsin being able to accept ballots up to 3 days late, as long as they were postmarked by Election Day. The Roberts Court, with Brett Kavanaugh writing for the court, at least part of the decision, said that states didn't have the right to do that. You know, so here we are in a pandemic. Many people are rightly frightened for their lives and health, and the Republicans are trying to stop their votes from being counted, even if they were filed by Election Day. So on the right, the desperate drive to keep votes from being counted because they know they have a minority agenda, that's striking. But I hope we'll get to, by the end of this conversation, to some of the exciting things happening in this election that weren't there in 2016 and that really, really deserve recognition, because there's been incredible mobilizations at the grassroots and actually largely by individuals and organizations outside the Democratic Party who were doing this even before they knew who the candidate would be, because they knew, as Sheldon Whitehouse said in the clip you played, this is about power. Hmm.
Today, we're speaking with Nancy McLean, an award-winning scholar and professor of history and public policy at Duke University. She's the author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And before we go to break, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Joan in Oakland. Hi, Joan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. One second, turn down my radio. Thank you so much for all of this valuable information. My question is, a lot of the people in the Congress must be aware of all this, besides Sheldon Whitehouse. Why aren't they speaking up, and why isn't it a clear message to the American people with the facts? I mean, when you hear this, it's obvious. Why are we not getting this message? I mean, it's been going on for years, and nobody speaks up about it.
Thank you, Joan. I think that's an incredibly important point and a source of frustration. One of the things that the right does very effectively and that some people do is to say that when you point to these incredibly powerful, wealthy individuals who are working to rig our politics through literally hundreds of organizations, for example, that the Koch Donor Network funds, they say, oh, you're engaging in conspiracy theory. And the truth is, it's much worse than a conspiracy. You know, a conspiracy would be a small thing. This is a long-term calculated, integrated effort to transform our institutions in multiple ways, using literally hundreds of organizations, including the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Federalist Society, the State Policy Network. We could go on. But I think that somehow some of this hasn't resonated with the American people about beyond small numbers, about the power and the influence of the Koch network. And so I think, sadly, some Democratic politicians shy from calling this out by name. So they just talk about it as though it's a partisan effort from the Republicans. But I think that, as you're getting at, is a real problem, because there are people who are tribal about their parties now, right? If you just say it's Republicans, they think it's an attack on them. But what they need to understand is that these Republicans that they're voting for are, in effect, using them to enact policies that will please the donors and that will hurt these self-same voters. And again, trying to eliminate the Affordable Care Act in the midst of a pandemic is probably the most dramatic example of that we could point to.
Well, Joan, thank you for the question. And after a break, I'll ask Nancy why this is not getting more attention in the media. It, like she said, it's not a conspiracy. It's all been documented. So why don't the media just call this for what it is? Today, we are speaking with Nancy McLean. And if you haven't already, I hope you can get your hands on her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will get an update on Republican-sponsored voter suppression. Nancy just talked about the ruling, and we also talked about it a couple days ago, the Supreme Court ruling that ballots cannot be counted after Election Day in Wisconsin. Well, in Pennsylvania, Republicans have gone back to the Supreme Court for a second time to invalidate ballots received after Election Day. The AG of Pennsylvania was actually on CNN last night, and he said they've won five times, and yet Republicans are still going back to try to invalidate the ballots. So we will get an update on all of that tomorrow. We are speaking with Nancy McLean, an award-winning scholar and distinguished professor of history and public policy at Duke University. She's the author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And if you have any questions for Nancy, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Nancy, you can hear the frustration in Joan's voice.
Yes.
And, you know, we cover these issues on a regular basis, and you're not being biased or not balanced by just calling it for what it is. So what are your thoughts about how the media deal with this? I mean, even with voter suppression, they just sort of say voter suppression. But this is, like you say, a decades-long plan by Republicans, and it's just rare for them to call it for what it is. Why do you think that is?
I think some of the media's traditions are really actually inflicting harm on us now. I mean, one tradition is even-handedness, right? That they want to be neutral. They want to say on the one hand, on the other hand. And the truth is, so for example, every time now that they speak of the extreme partisanship, you know, or the partisan interference in the election, that is misleading the public. And it increases the distrust and the rage, frankly, that's building in many quarters against government in America. I was reading something the other day about these incidents that have occurred in many parts of the country, you know, different violent incidents and, you know, threats to the election. And they were all coming from the right, right? They were all coming from Republicans. But the framing of the story was that this was extreme partisan behavior. And it made it sound like both parties were doing it. And that is simply not true. And as long as reporters continue to follow those old conventions, we're going to be in real trouble. You know, imagine, you know, and I won't even go to where I was going to go, but, you know, there have been different crises in history where you can see that kind of pretending to be balanced by not reporting that one side is behaving egregiously and the other side is being affected by that egregious behavior. That is, you know, misinformation of it in its own right. So I think that's part of it. I think we also have to be mindful of the incredible power that wealth on the scale of the Koch network brings. The British journalist George Monbiot at one point pointed out that when David Koch was still alive, but that if you combined David and Charles's wealth, you'd have the wealthiest person in the world. Koch has already also convened over 600 donors who give a minimum of $100,000 a year for this project, many giving far in excess of that, and including, you know, the Kochs themselves and Koch Industries. So this is incredible wealth, and it's gone into all kinds of things and front groups. You know, Americans for Prosperity, they have a group called Concerned Veterans of America. They have the Independent Women's Federation. They have something called Libre for Latinos. And all of those groups kind of can mobilize people and frankly can attack people who point this out. So I experienced that myself when Democracy Democracy in Chains came out, at that point, I didn't actually know how many Koch-funded faculty members there were in universities around the country. But boy, they all came out of the woodwork to pile on and to attack the book and attack me. And their charges were specious. You know, they were the equivalent of climate denial, attempting to create a controversy where nothing was, in fact, controversial. And the book was extremely well-sourced and well-reviewed by people outside the right who didn't have an axe to grind. But these people, you know, they defend their cause aggressively and with whatever it takes. And so I think in that context, people in the media know that. They know they're going to be bombarded. They know they're going to be harassed. You know, anybody, scholars, for example, or others who appear on Fox News or are mentioned by Fox News, get kind of a fascistic response in terms of their email, phone calls, you know, other kinds of harassment. So I think that a lot of people, you know, they're afraid of setting this off. They're afraid of becoming victims of this. But frankly, you know, when you ignore bullies, they just get more and more powerful. And I think we have to treat them as we were all taught, you know, in grade school about how to treat bullies and to expose and isolate them and stop the behavior. And if we don't do that as a country, we're going to be in big trouble.
We have an email from a listener, Stefan, who says, is there an equivalent of the Federalist Society on the left who can assist a Democratic administration in the way that the Federalist Society has aided Republicans? Why does it seem that the Republicans are so successful in enacting their far-reaching agenda?
Yeah, that's a really important question. There is an organization called the American Constitution Society that is trying to at least provide some kind of counterweight to the Federalist Society. It's much smaller. It's much less well-funded. It's much less ideologically driven. And it doesn't use stealth in the way the Federalist Society does. And as Sheldon Whitehouse and Washington Post and other reporters have shown, so it's out there, but there is nothing yet on the scale of that. But I do think actually that if you look at the progressive side, there are incredible resources on the progressive side, you know, community organizations, unions, feminist groups, civil rights groups, environmental groups, all of these, have large followings. In some cases have significant funding or dues bases and contributors. And the challenge for us, I think, is to get all of us rowing together in the same direction to realize, and I think people are in this election as never before, but realizing we are at an existential moment of crisis for democracy. And if we don't reclaim this, like certainly with this election, but then after that, with serious structural democracy reform and pushing back on these donors and this disinformation, we're going to be in serious trouble. But again, I think the overwhelming public opinion is on our side. I think we have huge resources of all kinds, incredibly, you know, smart and thoughtful and engaged people, all those good civil servants Trump is trying to purge, you know, the creative artists. There's so much on our side, but we need to inform people that this is happening, to get a common understanding, and then to work together for the kinds of structural democracy reforms and attacking economic inequality and systemic racism that have enabled things to get to the point they've reached now.
You know, one of the things that really has stuck with me in your book, Nancy, is thinking about what Tyler Cohen said about where we might end up. He co-presides, I'm not sure if he still does this, but when you wrote your book, he co-presides with Charles Koch over their base camp at George Mason. He's a best-selling author. He writes about the economy. And I was so struck by what he said. He basically was talking about the plan to just get rid of social services. He says the United States as a whole will end up looking more like Texas. He talked about how the quality of water might not be what citizens are used to. He talked about having partial shanty towns. Can you talk about this? Because this is the one thing that really stood out for me, just how honest he was and how brutal he was.
Yeah. I mean, just the absolute, I don't know, like, disassociation with the consequences of this project for the lives of real people, one's neighbors and fellow citizens, was astonishing to me when I read that. And what was interesting is he wrote it as though he were this brilliant, you know, seer, this prognosticator, you know, showing us what our future was going to look like, as if the invisible hand was doing it all. But in fact, when you know that he's been cooperating with Charles Koch for 25 years to make this happen, it becomes all the more horrifying, really. That conclusion of the book, where I used their words to indict their project, was actually chilling for me to write, in the same way that you're talking about it being chilling to read. And also, it was so interesting when he specifically talked about the water quality, and that was soon after he wrote that, the Flint water crisis was happening, and that emergency manager who switched the water supply of Flint to a cheaper water supply was the product of legislation brought into being by an organization in Michigan, a state organization funded by Charles Koch, who pushed for these emergency managers who are complete autocrats. They are not accountable to the people, and they're imposed on communities that are in fiscal crisis. And by that point, of the Flint water crisis, which has not ended, by that point, 50% of African Americans in Michigan were living under these, in effect, dictatorial local regimes because of the kind of legislation pushed by organizations funded by Charles Koch.
Wow. He also says that lower income parts of the country, we would basically have favelas like we see in Rio, for example. And when you think about it, I mean, inequality is widening. We have massive homeless crisis in all parts of the country. I was just driving by a homeless encampment on the freeway in the East Bay, just tent after tent after tent.
Absolutely. And the Koch network organizations have also been funded organizations pushing the litigation to stop people from getting eviction relief, to make it so it's easier to evict people. So they're absolutely bringing this world into being. You know, I'm sure when listeners hear that, the first response of, you know, any normal person is, my God, who would do this? What kind of person would do this? And so I think it's important to realize that they're doing this, imagining that they are good people and that this is an ethical system, because they say they are libertarians. They want us to be in a world where we are wholly personally responsible for everything in our lives. So the idea is that if you haven't paid your rent, or if you cannot get a job, you should suffer the consequences of that, because it is your fault. It is not the system's fault. It is your fault. And your suffering will teach you to save, and your suffering will also teach others that they must save. So it is an ethical system, I have tried to convey to people, but it is such a dark and punitive and ugly system. It's actually at odds with the best of every major religious tradition in the world, which is why I think it's really important that faith communities also learn about this Koch network project and what libertarianism actually means, because, you know, it means like these people who refuse to wear a mask to protect others or themselves in the midst of a pandemic. Most of that is being driven by these libertarian views and the action to stop governors from having mask ordinances is the litigation action is coming from these donor funded libertarian outfits. So it's really something. And also, I think the other thing that's really important for people to grasp, and I feel almost more aware of this now than when I published the book in 2017, Koch Industries is based in fossil fuels, right? And this is overwhelmingly something that is coming from the most reactionary, extractive, and particularly fossil fuel sectors of our economy, from wealthy corporate officials who see action on the climate, action to stop fossil fuels, as an existential threat to their source of profits. And the sooner we realize that, that that's driving so much of the misinformation we're seeing and so much of the ugliness we're seeing, I think that also helps people to understand what the solution is. In part, I mean, we must do the structural democracy reform, but also pushing for things like the Green New Deal chokes these industries, will choke off the funding sources, really, to be doing this devastating, these devastating shenanigans that involve rigging democracy.
Today, we're speaking with Nancy MacLean, professor of history and public policy at Duke University and author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you doing? The question was asked, why aren't we here? Why doesn't the public hear very much about all of these stealth organizations that have been working for 40 years or 40 or 50 years? And I have another answer that I can give you in one sentence. Hello? Are you still there?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. The answer is that Mike Bloomberg is a Democrat. I mean, he's a multi-billionaire, and he has many multi-billionaire corporations, and those are the people that finance the Democratic Party. And the DNC is on that side. Mike Bloomberg's main motivation in coming in was to make sure that that horrible socialist Bernie Sanders didn't get any traction, because Bernie was for the policies that the population wants. Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, more taxes on the rich. So there are almost as many Democrats that are fighting these policies as there are Republicans. And in fact, the two main television stations that are supposedly Democrat are MSNBC and CNN. And they agree with Mike Bloomberg. Heaven forbid we should have these terrible socialist actions like everybody getting Medicare.
Well, thank you for the call, Lawrence. Let's get a response from Nancy.
Yeah, thank you for that, Lawrence. There is a fight going on right now for the soul of the Democratic Party, and I quite agree with you that in a money-driven political system, top Democrats have been appeasing, you know, many aspects of this rather than challenging it head on. I will say that there are no Democrats that I know about who have promoted voter suppression. I think that's a kind of a bright line between the two parties. But there's no question that big money is distorting Democratic politics, you know, Democratic Party politics in the way that it's distorting our whole system. And I think part of the call for structural democracy reform is to expose that, to push for transparency for things like publicly financed elections. But one of the things that's been most gratifying to me in watching this and seeing the impact of Bernie Sanders is how many people have been inspired to run. You know, AOC is only the most famous, right, and the most beloved to so many for her brilliance and her sense of humor and her political talent. But you know, there are people all around the country who were moved by that message, who are either in office or in races now, trying to change things and trying to wage that fight for the soul of the Democratic Party and to reform our very systems of government and the way that the party is operated. So I think it's an important point. I think it's also important to recognize how many people are trying to act on that.
Right. And you also have younger, more progressive Democrats who are winning races against corporate Democrats who've been in office for many, many years. And then also, Nancy, I was reading a really interesting piece. What was it, in the Financial Times, about all of these incredible women running in Texas? I mean, this is amazing to see what's going on in Texas. Massive, massive voter turnout.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and I just, I'm glad that we're kind of coming to this, because I'm feeling, guardedly hopeful and inspired now, partly because there's so much in place now and focused and directed in a way that wasn't in 2016. So, you know, we've had the Women's March, we've had the Movement for Black Lives, we've had Indivisible, we've had a host of national and state efforts in my state. There are a couple of groups that are mobilizing to change politics and to win progressive policies to make the Democratic Party more progressive. And run progressive candidates. I'm in North Carolina. That's happening. But as you say, you know, who would have thought Texas could possibly be in play? Who would have thought Georgia, you know, could possibly be considered as a possible place for Democratic victories? So there is so much going on now at the grassroots level, so much incredible energy and mobilization that I think, you know, if we're not seeing it, we should look for it because it's out there. And it's really a time not to be, you know, overwhelmed or daunted or depressed by what is happening, but instead to realize this is the fight of our lives. We have got to get into it. And there are people who are determined to break through. As a historian, I believe this moment, the closest analogs to this moment in our history are the 1860s and the 1930s, moments of intense crisis where people I refer to as property supremacists were determined to wreck democracy to protect their prevailing wealth and systems of operation, and mass mobilization by the people, including electorally, interrupted that. And we had, you know, emancipation. We got the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments came out of the Reconstruction period. And, you know, in the 1930s, we know that we got the Wagner Act, the growth of the CIO, the development of New Deal policies. So I really believe that we're at one of those junctures. And part of the reason that everything is so fraught now is that the rule rigging is kind of containing the energy so that it gets, you know, kind of explosive, and it even gets kind of I don't know, toxic in some places, you know, from frustrations and stuff. But I really do believe there is a wave, you know, starting to crest here. And it's going to be really interesting and important to see how it plays out. And going back to Lawrence's point, winning on election, you know, election day, election week, whatever it is this year, that's not enough, right? I mean, I think the Obama presidency, the experience of that shows that progressives have to keep going. You know, it's democracy beyond elections. Keep mobilizing. You know, Joe Biden needs to hear from the Sunrise Movement. He needs to be pushed on the Green New Deal. This administration will need to be made accountable and answerable to its base. But I really do think the possibilities are there for an incredible breakthrough if there are, you know, as people say in the South, enough hands on the freedom plow.
One more stat on youth vote. According to CNN, early voting among people aged 18 to 29 is up across 14 critical states. I mean, the numbers are really incredible. In Florida, the share of the youth vote is almost double what it was this time 4 years ago. And voters under 30 in Texas is up 600% from 2016.
Yes. I mean, and it's just so interesting to see all of this. I mean, seniors are also breaking from the Republican Party because they're seeing that this administration is incompetent to act on the virus and coronavirus and is actually indifferent to the toll that it's taking on people's lives and whole communities. So I think, again, you know, guardedly optimistic, the Republicans and their donors are doing everything that they can to suppress votes and to steal this election as they got those ill-gotten Supreme Court seats. But the magnitude of the progressive mobilization, you know, I'm saying this as somebody who's going out to do voter protection later this week and phone banking tomorrow afternoon again. And, you know, I think we all have to be finding ways to contribute to this. But if we do, I really believe, and if we keep on the task after the election, you know, and into a new administration, and focus on our states and local communities too, this could be a really transformative era for the better. It, to, you know, address all the bottled up needs and visions that have been there.
Well, Nancy, I know we need to let you go right now. So thank you so much for joining us. We would love to have you back after the election.
Thank you, Rose. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you and hear from your listeners. Take
you
care.
Too. Thank you so much. That is Nancy McLean. She is author of the very important book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And Nancy goes in to detail looking at the history of this plan and how we got to where we are today. I hope you can take some time to read this book and share it with friends and your circle. And then also, we are going to put up a link to Sheldon Whitehouse's speech he gave when he was questioning Amy Coney Barrett about dark money. We will also put up an article about how people are trying to really fight all of this. Well, the early voter turnout really tells you a lot, because almost 73 million people have already voted. And coming up tomorrow, we are going to get an update on early voting. We know that 1-2% of absentee ballots could be rejected. This week, the Supreme Court ruled that ballots cannot be counted after Election Day in Wisconsin. In Pennsylvania, Republicans have gone back to the Supreme Court for a second time to invalidate ballots received after Election Day. And so we will be joined by Ari Berman. He's an amazing reporter with Mother Jones who's been keeping track of what's happening on the ground. And then we will go to a couple of battleground states to get the latest on early voting. Be sure to check your county clerk's website for information on in-person voting or where to drop off your ballot at an official drop box. And then, depending on where you live, you can also track your ballot to make sure that it has been counted. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find our past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.